When I was handed control of an entire hospital ward on Christmas Day as a new junior doctor, my consultant left me with 8 chilling words. Merry Christmas, Allie. Try not to kill anyone. Overwhelmed by patient emergencies and dropping medical supplies across the floor, I realized my usual strategy of simply working harder was failing spectacularly. This crisis moment led me to question everything I'd been told about productivity. Was success truly meant to be painful? Did productivity require suffering? The answer, as I would discover, was a resounding no. What if the secret to accomplishing more wasn't grinding harder, but actually feeling better first? This counterintuitive approach, what I call feel-good productivity, has transformed not just my work, but countless lives worldwide. It's the philosophy that helped Netflix grow from a rejected blockbuster pitch into a $300 billion company. And it's the science behind why positive emotions don't just feel nice, they fundamentally change how our brains work and what we can achieve. Richard Feynman, one of history's most brilliant physicists, found himself utterly bored with his field after his wife's death in 1945. Despite being appointed as one of Cornell's youngest professors, he couldn't bring himself to do research. Everything changed when, sitting in the university cafeteria, he noticed something curious. A student's spinning plate wobbled faster than the plate itself. This trivial observation sparked an epiphany about what had originally drawn him to physics. Play. I used to play with it, Feynman realized. I used to do whatever I felt like doing, whether it was important for nuclear physics or just interesting and amusing for me. He decided to approach physics not as a job, but as a game. I'm going to play with physics without worrying about importance whatsoever. This playful investigation of wobbling plates eventually led to insights about quantum electrodynamics that won him the Nobel Prize. Feynman isn't alone. At least 6 Nobel Prize winners attribute their success to play. Watson and Crick played with molecular models to discover DNA structure. Alexander Fleming played with microbes to discover penicillin. Play isn't just for children, it's a powerful productivity engine for adults, too. As children, our days overflow with adventure and exploration, but adulthood squeezes this spirit out of us. This is a mistake. A 2020 experiment tracking participants' locations and emotions found that those who had more adventurous experiences, taking new routes or trying different coffee shops, felt happier, more excited, and more relaxed. Adventure is perhaps the first major ingredient of play and happiness itself. To recapture this sense of adventure, consider your play personality. Dr. Stuart Brown, after interviewing over 5,000 people, identified 8 types: the collector, competitor, explorer, creator, storyteller, joker, director, and kinesthetic. Identifying which character resonates with you can help approach work with playful adventure. Finding the fun in tasks transforms productivity. When exhausted from studying for medical exams, I recalled Mary Poppins' wisdom. In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun and snap, the job's a game. I wrote, "What would this look like if it were fun?" on a post-it note and stuck it to my monitor. The next day, facing tedious biochemistry pathways, I realized studying could become enjoyable with the Lord of the Rings soundtrack playing. This simple question transformed draining tasks into more enjoyable experiences. Olympic sport climbers demonstrate another approach, focusing on process over outcome. Unlike most athletes' intense focus, climbers seem genuinely relaxed and joyful during competition. They immerse themselves in the process rather than fixating on winning. This approach works even in mundane situations, as Matthew Dix discovered while working at McDonald's. Bored with repetitive tasks, he created BBQ Sauce Day challenges to upsell customers, transforming tedious shifts into engaging games. To truly embrace play, we must lower the stakes. Studies show that when rats are restrained under mesh for 30 minutes, they stop playing entirely. Similarly, humans play more freely in comfortable, non-threatening environments. NASA engineer Mark Robber's experiment with 50,000 people revealed that when participants received an error message with a meaningless 5-point penalty, they made less than half as many attempts to solve coding puzzles compared to those who received no penalty. Success isn't about avoiding failure, but reframing it as valuable data. Alan Watts offered profound wisdom with his phrase, "Don't be serious, be sincere." Like playing Monopoly, life is best approached with sincerity rather than seriousness. The serious player obsesses over rules and winning, while the sincere player remains fully engaged without becoming fixated on outcomes. Reed Hastings and Mark Randolph's Netflix journey from being laughed out of Blockbuster's boardroom to building a $300 billion company demonstrates the power of culture. Chief Talent Officer Patty McCord created a revolutionary workplace focused on freedom and responsibility, eliminating traditional policies like vacation days and set hours. This approach to personal empowerment, feeling that your job and life are in your control, is the second key energizer for feel-good productivity. Self-confidence dramatically impacts performance, as shown in a University of Illinois study where students told they were fit enjoyed exercise more than those told they were unfit, regardless of actual ability. Psychologist Albert Bandura's concept of self-efficacy explains this phenomenon. Our belief in our abilities affects our actual performance more than the abilities themselves. This confidence isn't innate but learnable through techniques like positive self-talk, which research shows can significantly improve physical performance. A 2014 Bangor University study showed cyclists who used motivational self-talk phrases like "you're doing well" significantly improved their performance and reduced perceived exertion. The confidence switch technique involves asking, "What would it look like if I were confident at this?" and then behaving accordingly. We also gain confidence from observing others, a social modeling approach to building self-efficacy. In a study at Clemson University's outdoor lab, children who watched videos of someone climbing a wall before attempting it themselves performed significantly better than those who received no such preparation. This vicarious mastery experience demonstrates how seeing others succeed boosts our own confidence that challenges can be overcome. Like fictional heroes who transform from inexperienced beginners to powerful masters, we can boost our sense of power through what Bandura calls inactive mastery experiences, learning through doing. Drawing from Zen Buddhism, basketball coach Phil Jackson applied the concept of Shoshin, or beginner's mind, to transform the Chicago Bulls into champions. This approach means approaching tasks with the curiosity, openness, and humility of a beginner, free from preconceptions that limit experienced practitioners. Research from Stanford revealed that students who taught material to others learned better than those who simply studied for a test, a phenomenon called the protege effect. This might explain why firstborn children tend to have slightly higher IQs than their younger siblings. By taking on teaching roles, we deepen our own understanding while helping others. Psychologists Edward Deci and Richard Ryan revolutionized our understanding of motivation through their self-determination theory. They discovered that intrinsic motivation, driven by self-fulfillment and curiosity, is far more powerful than extrinsic motivation, driven by rewards and approval. Their research showed that autonomy, our sense of ownership, is crucial for building intrinsic motivation. Even in constrained situations, we can find ways to take ownership of our processes and mindsets, transforming "have to" into "choose to." While working as a junior doctor, I discovered the power of mindset ownership when asked to insert an IV line just as my shift ended. Initially resentful about staying late, I overheard a patient expressing gratitude for her care, which shifted my perspective. I realized I could transform my "have to" into "choose to." I was blessed to use my medical training to help a pregnant woman. Some people energize us while others drain us completely. Scientists recognize this phenomenon as relational energy, where our interactions significantly impact our mood. A 2003 study by Professors Cross, Baker, and Parker developed energy maps in large organizations, finding remarkable consensus about who energizes and who drains others. Our first insight into people's energizing effects comes from 1970s glam rock. Brian Eno, destined for mediocrity, had a chance encounter with saxophonist Andy McKay that changed everything. This meeting led to founding Roxy Music and becoming one of the century's most significant musicians. Eno later reflected that innovative musicians weren't working in isolation, but were part of larger scenes pushing each other to explore new ideas, what he called scenius. Building scenius into our daily lives requires reframing teamwork as a psychological state rather than just task division. Stanford professors Walton and Carr demonstrated this in a 2014 study where participants who believed they received tips from fellow participants versus from scientists felt they were working together rather than in parallel. This comrade mindset led them to work 48% longer on puzzles. When finding collaborators is difficult, synchronicity becomes powerful. A 2017 Ryerson University study showed that people who tapped their fingers to the same musical beat felt more connected and were more generous toward their synchronized group. While writing this book, I joined the London Writers Salon's Writers' Hour, where hundreds gather on Zoom, set intentions, then work simultaneously for 50 minutes. Though working on different projects, this synchronicity dramatically improved my focus and energy. Alan Lux, head of Big Brothers Big Sisters of New York City, noticed that volunteers often left even difficult mentoring sessions highly energized. His research with thousands of volunteers revealed that 95% felt happier, more fulfilled, and energized through service. The brain releases oxytocin and other feel-good hormones when helping others, creating a natural high lasting hours or days. As a doctor, I'd offer to make tea for nurses during breaks, a simple gesture that significantly boosted team morale. These random acts of kindness are subtle yet transformative ways to integrate the helper's high into daily life, boosting endorphins and helping us work harder. The helper's high reveals that asking for help can actually be a gift to others. Benjamin Franklin discovered this when he borrowed a book from a political rival who had been speaking against him. This simple request transformed their relationship into a lasting friendship, what's now called the Benjamin Franklin effect. Most of us underestimate others' willingness to help by up to 50%. When I launched my business, I drastically underestimated how much communication was necessary. My fear of being overbearing led to insufficient feedback, both positive and negative, that my team actually wanted. Different team members interpret shared information differently, so deliberate over-communication ensures you're sharing exactly the right amount. The Swedish proverb, "A shared joy is a double joy, a shared sorrow is a half sorrow," captures the essence of positive communication. Sharing good news increases psychological well-being for both parties through capitalization, where someone shares positive news and the recipient responds enthusiastically. Psychologist Shelley Gable identified four response types, with active constructive responses, "Wow, that's great," predicting relationship longevity and happiness. One viral video shows a guru holding a young man's head underwater until he nearly drowns, then declaring, "When you want to succeed as badly as you want to breathe, then you'll be successful." This motivation method for overcoming procrastination is nonsense. Many of us genuinely want to do the things we struggle with, but face real barriers. When motivation fails, some turn to discipline, doing things despite feeling unmotivated. But telling chronic procrastinators to just do it is like telling depressed people to cheer up. Instead, I propose the unblock method, understanding why we feel bad about work and tackling those issues directly. Like removing a pebble from your shoe rather than forcing yourself to run on it, this approach addresses the root causes of procrastination. The first blocker to productivity is uncertainty, a fog that prevents us from seeing clearly. Uncertainty paralysis occurs when we're overwhelmed by unknowns, leading to inaction. Humans naturally prefer predictability, and our tolerance for uncertainty varies. When facing uncertainty, we often, one, overestimate what's at stake, two, become hypervigilant to threats, three, stop recognizing safety cues, and four, avoid making decisions. Commander's intent originated in the German military tradition of Auftragstaktik, prioritizing a clear sense of why over detailed how instructions. This approach proved crucial during D-Day when paratroopers landed in wrong locations but still achieved strategic objectives because they understood the purpose. When applied to personal goals like fitness, it helps identify true motivations. For example, realizing that health and strength matter more than six-pack abs. The 5-Whys technique, developed by Toyota founder Sakichi Toyota to identify root causes of production problems, can be repurposed to maintain focus on what truly matters. By asking why repeatedly when considering a new project, you can determine if it connects to your ultimate purpose. After identifying your why, you need to convert purpose into concrete action. Traditional SMART goals have dominated goal setting since 1981, but research shows they can create tunnel vision and undermine intrinsic motivation. A 2009 Harvard study described goal setting as potentially addictive and corrosive. As an alternative, I propose NICE goals, near-term, daily or weekly objectives rather than distant targets, input-based, focusing on process like write 100 words daily rather than outcomes like hit bestseller list, controllable, within your actual power to accomplish, and energizing, incorporating play, power, and people. The crystal ball method, or pre-mortem, helps identify obstacles before they derail your plans. By imagining a week has passed and you haven't started your task, you can pinpoint potential roadblocks. Research by Wharton professor Deborah Mitchell shows this prospective hindsight increases our ability to identify reasons for success or failure by 30%. Time feels perpetually scarce, and contrary to popular belief, we don't all have the same 24 hours. Some people have more control over their time than others. A 2015 Boston University study showed remarkable results when participants were prompted to plan exactly when they would exercise. One group, given only Fitbits, saw no change in step count. Another group, who received daily prompts to identify specific time slots for activity, increased from 7,000 to 9,000 steps daily. These implementation intentions follow Peter Gollwitzer's formula, if X happens, then I will Y. Time blocking, putting everything important into your calendar, is deceptively simple yet underutilized. Rather than restricting freedom, structure actually provides more by ensuring you allocate time for all priorities instead of merely reacting to whatever arises. This chapter explores how fear blocks productivity by triggering our brain's amygdala to interpret challenges as threats, causing us to avoid action. Using Alex Honnold's fearless free solo climb of El Capitan as a starting point, the chapter explains how the amygdala's threat detection system can hijack our decision-making, leading to procrastination. While we can't eliminate fear completely, developing courage allows us to acknowledge our fears and move past them to unlock our potential. I resisted launching my YouTube channel for 7 years because of unacknowledged fears of failure and judgment. Understanding our fears is the crucial first step to overcoming them. A UCLA study with arachnophobes demonstrated that labeling our emotions when facing fears helps us overcome them. Participants who verbalized their feelings about a tarantula, "I feel anxious that the disgusting tarantula will jump on me," were more likely to approach it and reported feeling more in control. Sometimes our fears stem from negative self-labels that become self-fulfilling prophecies. Howard Becker's labeling theory showed how the labels we give ourselves affect our behavior. Fortunately, positive labels can overcome fear, just as negative ones can amplify it. When facing self-doubt, I call myself a lifelong learner, shifting focus from shame to growth. Survival psychologist John Leach's research on disaster victims reveals how fear can cause cognitive paralysis, the inability to think, decide, or act. Peter DeLeo's remarkable survival after a plane crash in the Sierra Nevada mountains demonstrates how some people can channel adrenaline productively rather than freezing. The 10-10-10 rule helps us gain perspective when fear paralyzes us through catastrophizing. When we turn minor setbacks into life-defining failures, we can ask three simple questions. Will this matter in 10 minutes? Will this matter in 10 weeks? Will this matter in 10 years? This cognitive reappraisal technique shifts our perspective, revealing that most failures won't define us forever. Self-doubt often creates a paralysis where we're suspended between wanting to do something and believing we can't. This can be understood mathematically. Self-confidence equals perception of ability minus perception of standards. When we believe our ability falls short of required standards, doubt creeps in. Rather than waiting for confidence to magically appear, we can simply ask, how confident do I actually need to feel to just get started? The spotlight effect makes us believe everyone is constantly watching and judging us, when in reality, people are primarily concerned with themselves. Psychology professor Thomas Gilovich's research confirms we consistently overestimate how much others notice our actions and appearance. Reminding yourself that no one cares can be liberating. No one cares if your first YouTube videos are cringy, if your early blog posts are rambly, or if you show up as a beginner to a dance class. When remembering no one cares isn't enough, we can adopt an alter ego, scientifically known as the Batman effect. Researchers at the University of Pennsylvania found that children who imagined themselves as superheroes showed better self-control, focus, and perseverance than those who didn't. I've used this technique for years, particularly when speaking in public. My alter ego is Charles Xavier from X-Men, triggered by putting on fake glasses, which is why I still wear them despite laser eye surgery. In 1684, Isaac Newton worked through nights to complete his magnum opus, the Principia, which included his first law of motion: objects at rest stay at rest, objects in motion stay in motion. This law applies to productivity as much as physics. It takes more energy to get started than to keep going. Beyond uncertainty and fear, our third major blocker is inertia, which flattens our emotional landscape and makes us feel stuck. To overcome inertia, we must reduce the friction that prevents us from starting. A Dutch study on vegetable shopping demonstrated how environmental tweaks can significantly change behavior. When researchers added green inlays to shopping carts with messages about popular vegetables, shoppers bought 50% more vegetables than the control group. Our physical environment often makes starting needlessly difficult. When I struggled to practice guitar while working as a doctor, my instrument remained hidden behind a bookshelf. After reading Atomic Habits, I realized the solution: place the guitar in the middle of my living room. This simple change made practicing the default choice. Beyond environmental obstacles, our mood often prevents us from starting, what Brits call CBA, or can't be arsed. This common paralysis can be tackled with the ancient 5-minute rule. Commit to working on a dreaded task for just 5 minutes, giving it your full attention. After that, you can decide whether to continue or stop. About 80% of the time, I continue working after the initial 5 minutes, but crucially, I allow myself to stop the other 20%, preserving the rule's integrity and effectiveness. Matt Machari coaches Silicon Valley elites like OpenAI executives and the CEO of Reddit, who credits him with adding $1 billion to his company's value. When interviewed about his seemingly miraculous coaching methods, Machari's answer was surprisingly simple: ensuring clients leave conversations with at least 1, 2, or 3 actions to take. This approach addresses a fundamental problem. Our difficulty in making progress often stems from not having clear, simple steps to follow right now. Tim Peichel, who has published over 25 papers on procrastination through his procrastination research group at Carleton University, offers a surprisingly simple method for overcoming procrastination, asking, "What's the next action step?" When procrastinating from yoga, his next step is simply rolling out his mat and standing on it. This approach works by shifting focus from intimidating long-term goals to achievable, immediate actions. Fantasy novelist Brandon Sanderson, despite his prolific output, frequently experiences writer's block. Rather than waiting for inspiration, he tracks his daily word count, refusing to stop until he reaches 2,000 words. A meta-analysis of 138 studies with nearly 20,000 participants confirms that tracking progress dramatically increases goal attainment. Tracking helps identify obstacles, celebrate small wins, and provides tangible evidence of movement toward goals. The Reddit forum r/getmotivatedbuddies connects 179,000 members seeking accountability partners for various goals, recognizing that starting something with another person is far easier than going it alone. Accountability partners boost motivation through both the energizing effects of social interaction and our deep sense of duty to others. Psychologist Michael Wall discovered that student procrastination was exacerbated by self-criticism. His research showed students who forgave themselves for procrastinating performed better on exams than those who dwelt on their failings. Self-forgiveness allowed them to move past their maladaptive behavior without the burden of guilt and shame. After leaving medicine to focus on his business, I found myself burned out despite having my dream job. Confiding in my psychiatrist mother on Christmas Eve 2020, I discovered burnout isn't just for overworked professionals, but happens when work stops feeling meaningful or manageable. The WHO defines burnout as an occupational phenomenon characterized by energy depletion, mental distance from work, and reduced professional efficacy, regardless of hours worked. I discovered a solution to overexertion by studying basketball star LeBron James, who, despite being one of the fastest NBA players, spends 74.4% of his court time walking, making him one of the slowest players overall. This strategic energy conservation has contributed to LeBron's unprecedented longevity in a sport where most athletes' prime lasts only 4.5 years. The lesson? Do less so that you can unlock more. When Steve Jobs returned as Apple CEO in 1997, he immediately cut the OpenDoc program despite years of development. He explained that focus means saying no to hundreds of good ideas to concentrate on what matters most, a philosophy that helped Apple become the world's most valuable company. Overcommitment is the first path to overexertion, saying yes to things that eventually grind us down. To resist overcommitment, I suggest creating an energy investment portfolio with two lists: dreams, hopes, ambitions, things you'd like to do someday, and active investments, projects you're currently investing energy into this week. The exercise helps clarify priorities and forces you to limit active investments to a manageable number, ideally in single digits. Derek Sivers offers a powerful strategy for saying no to commitments that drain your energy, the hell yeah or no approach. If a new opportunity doesn't generate immediate excitement, reject it. Also consider opportunity costs. Every yes is automatically a no to something else, so consider what you're giving up. Contrary to common belief, the optimal productivity isn't found in complete focus or constant task switching, but somewhere in between. A 2012 study by Adler and Benboon and Fitch revealed that occasional task switching can actually enhance performance compared to rigid single tasking. The relationship between distraction and productivity forms an inverted U-shape. Too much switching depletes cognitive resources through switching costs, while never switching can burn through focus reserves. To combat digital distraction, I recommend strategically adding friction between yourself and temptation. Journalist David Lengel transformed his life after switching to a basic Nokia phone, which dramatically improved his ability to be present with family. For those unwilling to abandon smartphones, uninstall addictive apps, use web interfaces instead, log out between sessions, or install tools that artificially slow down distracting websites. In 2008, psychologists Tyler and Burns conducted an experiment where students performed a mentally draining task, standing on one leg while counting backward by sevens from 2000. Afterward, they were divided into groups receiving different brake lengths before attempting a hand grip endurance test. The results were revealing. Those who received 10-minute brakes squeezed for 72 seconds on average, compared to just 34 seconds for the 1-minute brake group. This demonstrates that brakes aren't luxury, they're necessity. 2020 challenged Oxford lexicographers who couldn't select just one word of the year amid pandemic terminology like lockdown and social distancing. Yet doom-scrolling captured our collective experience, consuming endless negative content when we should be resting. This highlights depletion burnout, where our downtime fails to rejuvenate us. Most people discover a stark difference between what they automatically do when tired, scrolling social media, binge-watching shows, versus activities that genuinely energize them, walking, playing music, connecting with friends. Creative immersion can make us forget our worries completely. Psychologists have found that creative activities are particularly effective at helping us relax, offering four key benefits remembered by the acronym CALM. They unlock our sense of competence as we improve at our craft. They play to our feelings of autonomy by giving us control over what we're creating. They provide liberty by helping us disengage from work. And they help us mellow through their relaxed, low-stakes nature. Hobbies like painting, practiced by figures as diverse as George W. Bush, King Charles III, and Taylor Swift, exemplify the perfect calm activity. The key to maximizing a hobby's recharging potential is maintaining clear boundaries. Dedicate specific times and spaces for your creative activity, separate from work responsibilities. Remember that hobbies should be enjoyed for the process rather than results. Allow yourself to make mistakes and resist the urge to turn your hobby into work by monetizing it or seeking public validation. Roger Ulrich's groundbreaking research found that hospital patients with windows overlooking trees healed a full day faster than those facing brick walls. In further studies, even patients exposed to nature photographs required less pain medication than those looking at abstract art or blank walls. Decades of research confirms that nature triggers physiological responses that lower stress and rejuvenate concentration, which is why modern hospitals now commonly incorporate gardens and green spaces. You don't need extensive outdoor access to benefit from nature's recharging effects. Research shows even brief exposures work. University students who viewed a green roof for just 40 seconds made fewer errors on focus tests than those who viewed concrete. Similarly, listening to natural soundscapes for only 7 minutes left participants feeling energized for hours. Walking has been praised by figures from Steve Jobs to Virginia Woolf as essential for feeling truly rested. While philosopher Henry David Thoreau advocated 4 hours of daily walking, a luxury few can afford, research suggests quality matters more than quantity. A 2011 study found that walking generally reduces anxiety and time pressure, but environment and social context matter significantly. Participants felt more relaxed during park walks than street walks, more revitalized during solo park walks, and more energized during street walks with friends. The shower principle, where solutions to problems suddenly appear when we're relaxed, is backed by neuroscience. When our brain relaxes, the default mode network, DMN, activates, helping us recall memories, daydream, and imagine the future. Modern life rarely gives us time for mind wandering, yet doing nothing can be surprisingly productive. The Pacific Crest Trail spans 2,650 miles of challenging terrain from Mexico to Canada. When thousands of hikers attempt this arduous 5-month journey each summer, they present a perfect opportunity to study human motivation. Professor Kenan Sheldon used this setting to investigate motivation beyond the simple intrinsic-extrinsic dichotomy that had dominated psychology. His research revealed that when intrinsic motivation inevitably declined during the grueling hike, the hikers who tapped into identified motivation, doing something because they truly valued the goal, not only completed the trail more often, but also reported greater happiness. This insight points to the third type of burnout, misalignment burnout, which occurs when our goals don't match our sense of self. thinking about death can clarify what truly matters in life. After the 1994 Los Angeles earthquake, hospital employees who feared for their lives showed a significant shift toward valuing intrinsic goals, like relationships and personal growth, over extrinsic ones, like career advancement and material wealth. The greater their mortality threat, the more pronounced this shift. Stanford Business School's Lives of Consequence course assigns students to write their own obituaries as if they've lived an ideal life. This exercise, similar to the eulogy method, asks you to imagine what you'd want people to say at your funeral. Rather than focusing on career achievements, people typically emphasize relationships, character, and positive impact. Bill Burnett, who helped design the first Apple Mouse, developed the Design Your Life method by applying design thinking to personal development. The Odyssey Plan exercise asks you to envision three different five-year futures: continuing your current path, taking an alternative path, and pursuing a radical path unconstrained by money or social obligations. This exercise isn't about creating a concrete plan, but opening your mind to possibilities and discovering which path genuinely excites you. Values affirmation interventions are particularly powerful for those with low self-confidence. In a groundbreaking study published in Science, psychologists used these interventions to close the gender achievement gap in physics. Students were shown 12 possible values, from artistic ability to relationships to spirituality, and asked to write about their most important values. This simple exercise significantly reduced the gender gap in exam scores, especially for women who endorse stereotypes about men performing better in physics. I discovered the Wheel of Life framework during my penultimate year of medical school through Dr. Lillicrap's lecture on defining personal success. The exercise involves drawing a circle divided into 9 segments representing major life areas: 3 for health, body, mind, soul; 3 for work, mission, money, growth; and 3 for relationships, family, romance, friends. You then rate how aligned your current actions feel with your values in each area. The 12-month celebration converts abstract values into concrete actions. Imagine having dinner with your best friend 12 months from now, celebrating your progress in important life areas. Write down what you'd want to tell them about each value identified in your Wheel of Life. This positive visualization helps you identify specific steps needed to realize these celebrations: joining a gym, updating your CV, scheduling regular calls with family, transforming distant values into actionable steps for the coming months. For those who find yearly goals still too distant, the challenge becomes aligning daily decisions with our deepest values. Research by Anna Sutton at the University of Waikato shows that living authentically day-to-day not only increases well-being, but also enhances engagement with tasks. Each morning, I review my 12-month celebration document and choose 3 actions, one each for health, work, and relationships, that move me closer to my goals. My most powerful revelation when researching feel-good productivity wasn't any single study, but a method: applying scientific thinking to questions of happiness, fulfillment, and productivity. Alignment experiments help test theories about what brings you closer to alignment in day-to-day decision-making through a 3-stage process. First, identify an unfulfilling area of your life. Second, form a hypothesis about changing one variable. Third, execute the change while tracking its effects. My apartment is a 10-minute walk from one of London's biggest hospitals. Sometimes I wander there, watch doctors bustle through corridors, and reflect on how much I've learned since that catastrophic Christmas Day shift. My mistake wasn't what I thought about productivity, but how I thought about it, viewing it as discipline rather than finding what makes me feel good. Everything about my life has changed since then. I now know productivity isn't about discipline, but doing more of what energizes you, and that escaping procrastination requires finding joy even in difficult situations. The real error was believing I could master productivity by learning every hack rather than thinking like a productivity scientist. This book isn't a to-do list, but a philosophy, a way to create your personalized toolkit through experimentation. Try approaches, evaluate their effects on mood and energy, and discard what doesn't work. Don't rote learn your way to feel-good productivity. Experiment your way, strategically stumbling toward what works and transforming work from energy drain to energy source.